My name is Scott Arrington, and is everybody is going to be here? I wanted to take a survey. How many people here are in their teens? All right. The reason I kind of want to get a feel for this is I feel like this is a message for young people. We need to get young people entering. And you, I know, like me, most of you are young at heart, right? But we need to develop a love of agriculture among young folks. We don't have the numbers, and we're failing at that. We need to somehow correct that. And the way I've always thought you corrected that is to get people interested, is make it intellectually stimulating and make it rewarding. Let me introduce myself. Okay. My name is Scott Arrington. Like Daniel said, thank you for having me here. It's a beautiful place, and I appreciate Pastor Daniel inviting me, and I hope that you know this, you get something out of this. And I'll just introduce myself. I was baptized in 98. Before that, I was pretty much an agnostic. I'm kind of an analytical person. I couldn't see much proof of anything. You know, figured any religion was okay, whatever floats your boat. But, you know, was attracted to Adventism mostly for the health message. I wanted to be a vegetarian. I was failing miserably. So I wanted to hang around vegetarians. So I came into the church simply to hang around vegetarians. Pretty simple motive. And then, you know, stayed around long enough to hear a Daniel Revelation seminar. The whole thing about changing the Sabbath to Sunday kind of hit me like a ton of bricks. And then, you know, I was already into the health message. That was an easy sell for me. I mean, I was already there. And so I kind of got really into the health message right away. I had to walk away from my job. I was a merchant seaman. Had made it up to first officer. And was waiting for a captain's job. But, you know, sometimes I was slow to open up. So as I was on the beach, I was waiting around. And came into the Sabbath message and the Adventism, and kind of had to walk away from that career because there was just too many Sabbath conflicts. I mean, you couldn't walk off the ship bridge of a ship because it was Sunset Friday, you know. So, and there was not much you could do to stem that. So it was just kind of a career not really adept to observing the Sabbath. So I walked away from it, and because and I fell right in with a lot of hardcore, you know, medical missionary types, the health nuts, in some churches would call them. And that was okay with me because that's, you know, that's what I wanted. And I became a medical missionary by 2002, doing natural remedies and that sort of thing. And two things that kind of got me is as I was doing the medical missionary work, doing fomentations and going around to different people's houses and living with them, most of the people I was called to help, and you know, was Adventists. Like, wow, so that did, you know, all the stuff I'd learned, like, well, they have the health message. Why am I going to see Adventists? Well, you know, a lot of them weren't actually doing it. You know, it was something that it was part of the doctrine, but they weren't doing it. But a lot of it was they were doing it, and they were still getting sick. So that didn't seem to make much sense to me. And then the other thing has anybody ever heard of that network marketing thing called Manatech? No? Okay, some of you have, Manatech, okay. Well, down in Collegedale, it's close to Atlanta where I'm from, a lot of people were big into that. And the big sales pitch there was, you know, these polysaccharides, which are really healthy for you, are not in our foods anymore. You know, and you have to buy this product, Manatech, in order to have health because they've got the polysaccharides in them. And my question was, well, where did they get the polysaccharides? You know? And it was, oh, you have to go to the equatorial South America and, you know, high up on the Andes Mountains, and then you get plants that are full of polysaccharides. And then my question was, well, why don't our food have high polysaccharides? You know, does God really mean I have to traipse all the way to the Andes Mountains to get health? So that didn't hit me right. And these, you know, this was the logic. I was, you know, these were Adventists that were telling me this. And I said, well, that doesn't make sense, you know. So then I got into as I was convalescing with this guy who had colon cancer, I was helping him. Turns out he was a pretty good farmer. I was watching a home video with him as I was, you know, convalescing with him. And it was John Provine. Anybody know John Provine down in Tennessee area? Oh, good. Okay. And it was a video of him in a living room giving a home lecture. And, you know, when I first became an Adventist in 98, I tried square foot gardening. I bought the book, read, I think his name is something Bartholomew, read the book, and I was really interested in that. And I did the square foot gardening, as you see at the top of the page there. Everybody familiar with square foot gardening? Kind of looks like that. It's good for like small gardens, backyard gardens. And it just didn't, for all the work and all the money I put into it, I didn't have a lot of abundance. I didn't have a lot to show from it. It's like taking chemical nitrogen and putting on an organic nitrogen, and taking chemical phosphorus and putting on organic phosphorus. Sounded really good, and I thought the plants were just going to love me for it, but they kind of did just sort of mediocre. Like I said, I didn't get much abundance. I have a little square foot like garden like that. I was planting all kinds of things right next to each other. I think some things were crowding each other out in hindsight. I didn't know that was a problem then. And it just didn't work well for me. So then when I saw John Pervyance's video right there, John Pervyance in 2003, he started talking about microbes in the soil and about how the microbes interact with the root and bring the nutrition to the root, but you got to have the microbes there to begin with, and you got to farm a certain way in order to have microbes there. Well, that was like a piece of the puzzle I didn't hear from my square foot gardening book, you know. So I went chasing down John Pervyance. You know, I thought, well, he's got to still be around. It was an old video, but I thought, well, it didn't look like it was that old. So I found him, and I brought him back to where I was with this guy, and it was out in the country, and we did a garden. And he did a little of the mint lighter stuff, and he was mixing some concoctions. And he was talking about microbes, and I knew he didn't come up with this stuff, and I kept pressing him, like, John, where did you learn your information? And he wasn't telling me. He didn't want to give that up. But I kept working with him, and I kept, you know, building a relationship with him, and I kept pressing him. I said, where did you learn this stuff? Because he was kind of hit or miss. I knew he was kind of up there in age by this time, and he wasn't really, his methods weren't strict, you know. He was kind of all over the place with it. And finally he told me, and I went to an Acres USA conference, and they had the books, and I got some of those books I think I'm going to come to next, but that's when I went to my first Acres USA conference. That's when the light bulbs really started going. I started hearing people talk about how the microbes work and how you get them in your soil, and you know, there was different philosophies there, and they're competing philosophies, but the guy who invented, started Acres was saying, you know, I just don't want to, I'm only going to censor it as far as conventional agriculture. I'm going to put all the alternative agriculture things out there, and I'll let my public figure out which one they want to go with. But it's just not conventional. That's the only thing he censored out of his publications. And so when I went to my Acres conference, I really got excited, but, and I tried some things at the Oak Hill Chapel Farm, which was where John Pervyance and I were. And then in 2011, I keep going to Acres conferences, and they're going to have one in Lexington, Kentucky next year in December, like the first weekend of December. Anybody want to go? I'll share a room with you. Well, guys, you guys want to go? I'll share a room with you, because I love to go with them when they're close to the southeast. Sometimes they're up in Minneapolis, and I don't go to those, but anytime they're kind of relatively close, I go to them, and I would recommend anybody go to Acres conference. I traipsed across the country, went to Nebraska to see Neil Kinsey talk. That was a free conference, and usually he charges like $600 for a conference, but they had worked it out, you know, the town had worked it out where some of the businesses had contributed to his speaking fee, and they let us do it for free. So all I had to get there, all I had to do was get the travel and lodging, and I heard Neil Kinsey's talk for like a week. Very interesting fellow, Neil Kinsey. He has a soil lab. And then, even after 2005, I realized all I had was a bunch of head knowledge. And they really didn't know how to apply the things I was learning. And the golden nugget in agriculture is, how do you make it pay for itself? Small farming. People say it just does not pay. And that's what I was saying, because that's what I heard. And people I trusted said that, so I believed it. And I was praying about that. You know, I was like, I want to put this into practice, and I've learned some things that seem like they should work from these Acres conferences, but I want to know, can you make a living at this? And so, as Providence would have it, and I think it was, you know, it was Providence, I came into this, in 2006, I started as an intern on, kind of left the medical missionary stuff and started on, as an intern over here at Gaia Gardens. And this is a 20-acre town home development, and this is Daniel, the guy who trained me, and that's spring broccoli, and anybody knows it's hard to grow spring broccoli, especially down in Georgia where the springs are pretty short. Maybe here it's a little easier where your spring's a little longer. But to grow spring broccoli is tough. And he was real proud of that spring broccoli because that's a tough thing to do in the spring in Georgia. because our springs are so short. And it takes broccoli a long time to grow. Anyway, they developed half of their 20 acres into a 2-acre farm. And that's where I trained under. And Daniel was under contract with them. He didn't own the land. He was under contract with the community. And it was a good deal. I mean, I'll get into all that later. But I was able, because of the deal they worked out, because Daniel was there doing it for a living. This is how he made his living. So, man, that prayer was answered, right? And now, he was a certified organic part. It was part of his contract. And I was just floored. Now, in 2006, I think he'd been there 1 year. And I think he was grossing about $35,000 on an acre and a half of annuals and a half acre of blueberries. So it was 2 acres total, but an acre and a half of annuals. And I don't know, he was probably netting $18,000, something like that. As I stayed around that farm, and Daniel in his last year, which was I think 2008 or something like that, he was grossing $90,000 and keeping about $50,000. And he was a good farmer. Everybody loved him. He won the Land Stewardship of Award a year for Georgia at Georgia Organics Conference. And that's the guy I trained under. And so a lot of my things I'm telling you are not only the things I learned in the books, but things I was able to put in practice and methods that Daniel had taught me. And the person Daniel learned it from was the guy up in North Carolina called Alex Hitt of Paragine Farms. Anybody ever heard of him? Alex Hitt? H-I-T-T? He's not an old guy. He's kind of a, you know, the Southeast. He's kind of the small farmer go-to man. You know, he's been doing it for 30 years and making a living at it. So you can make a living small farming, and these guys are doing it. In 2007, I started this thing called Third Angel Farm, and I did my own little sort of satellite farm away from Daniel, and was able to at least pay for expenses and make a little bit of a profit. 2008, I took that off and just worked on the compost at Gaia Gardens and helped them with the bees. In 2009, there was a new farmer at Gaia Gardens, and I sort of assisted them making that transition in. And that's the cool thing. And this is what I would love to see, is churches with a bit of land make it conducive for a young farmer to come in there and work that land and be able to make a living at it and want them to make a living at it. And this is what these secular town folks had done. So when Daniel left, the other lady that they recruited was able to come in and start making money on his model from the get-go. And I helped her make that transition. So in 2010, I did a church farm down in Georgia. I got to talk to an Adventist church. Let me do an eighth of an acre down there. It was an eighth of an acre, which is like 5,500 square feet. I probably grossed $6,500 and, you know, netted about $1,000. So I didn't do too good the first year. But by the 2011, I had grossed $17,000 and was keeping $12,000. So, you know, it takes time to get those numbers up. But Atlanta's a good market. You know, there's a lot of disposable income there. And, you know, there's got a lot of things got to fall into place. But so that's my story, and that's who I am. And now, get past that. Before I get into that, how many of you here want to just do a backyard garden? Okay. And how many here wants to do somewhere between a quarter of an acre? So the backyard garden, I'm going to assume, is less than a quarter of an acre. Okay. How many people here want to do like somewhere between a quarter acre and 3 acres? Okay. And then how many people want to do 3 acres and on up? Okay. You want to do more than 3 acres? Okay. Well, most of the talk is going to be geared towards the 3 acres and under crowd. But the things I learned on that acre and a half, you can take it, that seems big, and we had a tractor, but we didn't need a tractor. But you can take those same things and apply it to your backyard, okay? The reason these things work is the people that I learned them from were making a living at it. Now, how many people have seen that video, Back to Eden, on the internet? The guy with all the wood chips? Okay, a lot of people have been asking me about that guy. He just makes it sound easier than it is. I don't do that kind of farming. I'm not into heavy mulching. But what I will say is that, you know, Well, I forgot what I was going to say about that, but we'll get into that later. But this talk is going to be geared to the 3 acres or less people, and you can use these. Oh, I know what I was going to say is that this guy Paul on the Back to Eden, he's not making a living at it. He's just doing it, okay, in his backyard. He looks like he has a lot of time out there, like he's maybe disabled a little bit and has some, you know, he's retired, and he can kind of putz around at it. I learned from people that were having to make a living. And when you learn from people that have to make a living at it, it's hit it, you know, you're either sink or swim. And that's who, if you really want to learn this stuff, go volunteer for a day or 2 days. Show up when you say you're going to show up and learn from somebody who's making a living at it. And go to an organic farm, not a conventional farmer. And even if you want to go off organic a little bit, at least you can learn how to do it organically. And then you can venture off a little bit if you want to. But learn from somebody who's making a living at it, and you're going to learn streamlined methods, because these people don't have a lot of time to mess around. Not like somebody who's retired and just sort of out there, you know, trying to put money, a little bit of supplemental food on their table. These guys are trying to make, you know, put a roof over their house, pay their retirement, you know, do everything on a small farm, and they're doing it. People are doing it. So that guy on Back to Eden with all the mulch, it doesn't look like he's doing that. So I would still go with the guys I learned from. These are two books that are in your bookstore. I got Paul Glenn over at Potomac, ABC, to bring them here. First one is Teeming with Microbes. Just want to get this in. This is a book I recommend on my book list that everybody start out with. It tells you why you're doing bio-friendly and farming and not going and just getting Miracle-Gro or 10-10-10. You know, if you really want to, in order to have respect for the living organisms of the soil, you kind of need to meet the living organisms in the soil and know what's down there, even though you can't see them. And this book will introduce you to the whole cast of characters in fertile living soil. And it's written by a guy named Jeff Lowenfels. I heard him speak at an Acres conference. Really knowledgeable guy. He's a trial lawyer, and he's able to explain real complicated things to juries. So he's really able to explain the soil food web to people like us, or people like me, in a simple way, but a thorough way. So that is a great book. I think there's a few copies in the over there in the bookstore. And then I'm on the hook for this one. I got him to order this only if I agreed to buy anything that was left over. So please go buy that next book, Managing Cover Crops Profitably. That's another thing. Instead of wood chips, I get my ground fertile with cover crops. Everybody know about cover crops? It's not something just big farmers do. Small farmers can do it too. And it's a great cheap way of bringing the fertility into your soil again. I've got some free handouts and some free catalogs that I get and I use. I'll have them up here, you know, later on tonight and after the thing. I got some handouts that I had to photocopy myself, so I'm charging 25 cents a page for those. I'll have them back there, and just put the money in the bucket there, the ice bucket, and you know, you're on the honor system on that. And then I have some laminated bricks charts, which I encourage everybody to get, because basically that's what I'm going to be going over, these laminated bricks charts. Everybody heard of a bricks chart? I mean, some of you have. Okay, these are laminated, so you can take them out in the field. You can get them dirty and wipe them off. I love that. And in the back, it tells you, you know, why you should be concerned with bricks. And we'll get into that, too. But these are a dollar, and I encourage everybody here to get one of these before you leave. If you're leaving tonight to go to work tomorrow, at least pick up one of those bricks charts. And I'm not making any money on this. I'm just trying to cover some costs, okay? So, now, okay, I want to give a little bit of philosophy at first just to kind of motivate you and know why we do this thing. You know, I came in on the health message, like I said, and this was at the cover of a quarterly, you know, I don't know, a couple years ago, Health and Healing. And what struck me as funny is not really funny, but a little alarming, was the cover. We kind of look at, and this is what we kind of, you know, we grow up saying, you know, preaching fruits, grains, nuts, and vegetables. And this is kind of what we think, where they come from. But most of us are not eating right out of our garden. Most of us are going to Walmart or, you know, getting the cheapest bell peppers we can get or the cheapest tomatoes we can find. Maybe not tomatoes because we don't really like those tasting things. But all foods are affected by the way you farm. And this is the way they're farming most of our foods in the grocery store. You know, they're having to spray heavy chemicals on them where they have to wear hazmat suits, or they get some third world person who, you know, hey, who cares about them, to spray the heavy chemicals without the hazmat suits. A lot cheaper that way, but not for their health. Here's cornfields getting anhydrous ammonia pumped in them, which sterilizes the soil. It kills all your soil biology, but it gives you some nitrogen, and it'll grow some corn, and it'll give you corn yield. But, you know, yield's not everything. But we eat that corn. Here's some soybeans getting dusted. Here's a picture I took of strawberries getting sprayed. And they say just don't eat anything but an organic strawberry, because you can't wash some of that stuff off. It penetrates into the strawberry, you know. Peaches are the same way. This is another strawberry field, and you can see the skull and crossbones on that. Stay out of this field. If you see that, if your food is coming from a field like that, should we really be eating it? You know, I don't think so, no. And there seems to be a bit of a reality gap in that, you know, fruits, grains, nuts, and vegetables are great, but we have to go a little further, especially now, and realize where do they come from? Where are and how is it being grown? And who is growing it? And what's their motive for growing it? Is it just profit? Is it just yield? Or is it nutrition? Because the best example is a tomato. Everybody can relate to that. But the same thing you can see or experience with a tomato. You know, we don't like the tomatoes in the store because they taste like cardboard, right? And well, it's the same way with all fruits and grains, nuts and vegetables. If the way it's grown is not right, it doesn't have any taste. And if it doesn't have any taste, it doesn't have any nutrition. And you can eat it all day long, and you're still going to come up short on your vitamins and minerals and your nutrients. And you're going to say, well, why did I get sick? I followed the Advent's message to a T all my life. Well, you didn't concern. I'm not going to say this is a be-all and end-all, but you know, there's probably other factors too. But one of the possibilities is the food that you were eating wasn't grown in a nature-respecting method that saves the soil for generations to come and gives us good, nutritious produce at the same time. And it can be done. We don't have to wreck our soils to get food. We can actually build our soils and get good food. So we have to kind of come off this sort of reality gap and realize this is what's going on with fruits, grains, nuts, and vegetables, not this. Okay, we got to just bite the bullet and realize that and make roads to correct the situation. Okay. All right. This showed up in some periodical. I thought it was interesting. This is a report saying, you know, the top first year income makers right out of college are, out of all the colleges in the United States, are graduates from Loma Linda. They make $71,400 a year their first year out, average. And at first, you know, your chest wants to kind of swell with pride and think, way to go, Adventists, right? But you got to realize, we're above MIT, we're above Harvard, we're above Stanford, we're above Princeton, because most of our Loma Linda graduates are all in the medical field, and that is a growing industry. Sick people are a growing industry, and we're cleaning up on the back end. We need to get on the front end of this. And I know everybody loves money, but in a way, this isn't something we should be too proud of. Okay? Where are our farmers? We got a lot of doctors, we got a lot of nurses, we got a lot of medical staff, but where are the where are the young people going into farmer growing good nutritious food? So maybe people don't go into the hospital in the first place. And that's what I just thought that was interesting. Now, you know, sometimes you run into people who think, well, this is all kind of, you know, hippie stuff and, you know, tree hugging stuff and, you know. And it isn't. This is part of our fundamental beliefs. Fundamental belief 21, might be 22 now with the extra one, but anyways, it's still there. The Industrial Revolution has also resulted in air, water, and land pollution. Technology in some instances has manipulated nature rather than managing it wisely. We are stewards of this world and should do everything to maintain life on all levels by keeping the ecological balance intact. And then it goes on, you know, in Christ's coming, it will destroy those that destroy the earth. Well, what I'm going to tell you is, The way we spend our food dollar supports one method or another. It either supports, you know, are we spending our food dollar on people that are growing? If you can't grow it yourself, are you spending your food dollar with people that do grow it themselves, small farmers that are local? Are you spending it at the grocery stores? Your dollar will keep these guys in business, or they'll keep these guys in business. I mean, that's your power as a consumer. You can do something by the way you spend your dollar. And if I wasn't going to grow it myself, and if I don't grow something that somebody else does and I want it, I want to support these guys. And they're there in every town. Small farming's coming back. Farmers markets are coming back. And people are able to make a living at it, but you got to support them. And you got to realize you can't spend your dollar, because everybody wants that dollar bill in your pocket. And that's how you change the world, by how you spend your dollar bill. Okay? And that's how you change farming, by how you spend your dollar bill. Okay, 8 laws of health. We all know them. I like the New Start because it's, you know, one word, you know, it's kind of simple. But here's Daniel with his organic broccoli. He said, when he held that up there, he says, and this is why they call it a head. Because it's as big as his head. I remember that day. Or do we want to eat food out of this field right here? And, you know, if the 8 laws of health matter, then it seems like for things to dovetail and fit together, we should be wanting to eat out of these type places, either growing it ourselves or supporting people who do, and not out of these type places. Okay, that would just seem to fit with our 8 laws of health. And here we are. This is when in 2010, 2011, I had the church farm going on. And the trade was that I gave them, you know, billing, and I paid myself and my expenses. The church didn't have to really risk any money. They had the infrastructure already there. They had a water supply. I paid for the water. But other than that, they let me just sort of use the land. They weren't using it anyway. And I was able to pay my costs and then pay for my labor. And then, you know, I was also able to engage some of the other members of the church. Here's a gal who actually came out and volunteered some to help me. And then here she is at the market. Here's another fellow that was a member of our church. And you can see this is the church's name, Greater Atlanta Seventh-day Adventist Church. And they let me put the logo on the end there. And there's my logo on the other end. And then I call it Third Angel just so it would prompt the question. You know, what's a third angel? You know, and then you can get into, you know, you can't really evangelize at the market, but if people ask, you're certainly able to give them an answer. A thousand people a week saw this sign, and that's a thousand people a week seeing the Adventist logo. 100 people a week came in and bought from me, so that's 100 people a week. Most of them saying, well, where's your farm? And I say, well, it's part of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. They're sponsoring me on it. They said, well, that's a very good church to do that. They tell them thank you. But even though I was charging them money, they were seeing it as a community service because they didn't want to go out there and farm. You know, and they were glad to have some place they could come buy fresh organic produce. So I just think it's a real good fit for churches with land, okay? And it can work out. You can work it out. Why should we eat local? Well, number one, our health. It's fresher. It has more phytochemicals in it that we need. You know, the typical produce, they say, travels 1,500 miles that you buy at the store and has been sitting there 10 to 14 days. Okay, when you go to a farmer's market, you know, it may have been picked 2 days at the most. It might have been picked that day, and it hasn't maybe traveled at the most 60 miles to get there, maybe even less. So it's fresher, it's healthier, it tastes better because it's fresher, you know, it tastes better. Now you talk about relationships. That's a big buzzword in the church right now, relationships, all about relationships. Well, we need to have, you know, one of the closest relationships you have is your spouse, right? I mean, that is a close relationship. And what makes that part of that relationship so close and so bonding is because you're intimate with your spouse. And that's a very, you know, intimate thing. And when you eat something, that's a very intimate thing. You can't really get any more. There's only, two things that become part of you. And that's intimacy with your spouse and the things you eat. So if we're going to have this, we can sort of readily see that relationship with our spouse, but what we don't really see a lot of times is the relationship we need to have with the foods we take into our body. And it affects, and we need to know, we need to have relationships all through it. Who grows it, how it was grown, how what microbes were there that, you know, made it healthy. You know, all those are relationships we need to manage. And when you go and sell it like this in a local atmosphere, you're building community. I mean, the church knows, I mean, the people know you're there. Everybody, the whole people around that garden, the church-owned property, they knew about it because they weren't really interested in Adventism, but they sure were interested in growing healthy food. And that the fact that I was able to pull it off, that really made them interested. And so there was a connection there, and they appreciated me being there growing it that way. So this is just it's a relationship builder. You're having a relationship with the food you're eating, and it builds community. Helps the environment. That's sort of obvious. It helps the local economy, and when you buy at farmers markets, it helps endangered family farms. It protects a land from development. You know, instead of having land that just gets wiped out for a subdivision or a shopping mall, a farmer making money at it can keep that farm going and protect the land from just being paved over with asphalt. This is kind of interesting. I ran the numbers. These are for 2005. And basically, the big thing is arable land per person. If you divided the number in 2005, you've divided the number of people on Earth by the number of acres of arable land, you got about 0.55 acres per person. Now that's okay, but that's assuming we're all vegetarians. We could feed ourselves on 0.55 acres per person, right? Probably need about a tenth of an acre to feed yourself, or maybe a fifth. Maybe a 20th of an acre to feed yourself. Probably an acre would feed 20 people. But we're losing arable land every year to climate change, to development, urban sprawl, to desertification, which is probably related to erosion. We're losing arable land at a certain rate. I think that was the rate there. And the population is increasing. So I worked it out, just did the math, and by the year... in 62 years from 2005, so in 2067, maybe some of us won't be here, but our children will and our grandchildren will, we're going to be down to 0.05 acres per person, and that's not going to be left to land. Somebody's going to go hungry, and there's going to be wars over this. There's a looming food crisis just because the population's increasing and the arable land is decreasing. So I have it at 2067, and that's assuming everybody's being fed as a vegetarian. You know, you add meat, carnivores into that, and it's probably sooner than that, okay? So that's one reason we should be concerned. And here's the other reason. Now, this is one of my favorite slides. This is you can go online and look this up. This was an actual study done in the late 1990s. They were looking for, what do they call those studies where it's really hard to get them, where it's not in a laboratory, it's in, like, the real world, and you don't have a lot of other factors influencing it. They went to an indigenous valley in Mexico with an indigenous sort of Indian, you know, people, not Spanish descent, but Indian descent. And what had happened in the 50s after they had sort of soaked California with all the chemical agriculture and sold all the chemicals, they went down to Mexico and they tried to sell their chemicals to these indigenous Mexicans down there. And of course they had a town meeting and half of the people didn't want the gringos chemicals and the other half bought into the promise of higher yields and they took it. So the people that didn't want it moved up into the foothills, which is sort of less desirable soil, and the people who wanted it stayed down in the, you know, flatlands, which was better soil. And after three generations, like 50s, maybe it was the fourth generation, probably says on there, they took 4 and 5 years old, or 5 and 6, yeah, 4 and 5 years old, and they just asked them to draw themselves. And you can see, this is when the person living, and the only difference is the way they grew their food. One of them used chemicals, the other one didn't. They did the old way they'd always done it, without the chemicals. And you can see the children that lived in the foothills had some cognitive kind of awareness of themselves. They realized they had two eyes, they had two arms, two legs. These are the children in the valley. Now, you couldn't really tell the difference between these kids. They were all playing, they were all laughing. But when they asked them to draw themselves, this was a noticeable kind of alarming difference. And the only difference was the way their food was grown and what was used to grow it. And this kind of sobered me up. I don't know if it sobered you guys up, but I mean, I realized I was this kid. I never grew up in a chemical-free agricultural world. You know, it's been our farmlands have been soaked with chemicals ever since like the end of World War II. And this has got to make us all stop and think. Anyways, that's another reason to maybe take this a little more seriously. All right, where's the next? Okay. Sustainable versus conventional. This cow right here, you can see he's reaching, you know, he's being very inconvenienced in order to eat grass over here. Now people say, I guess this is where the saying, you know, the grass is always greener on the other side of the fence. Well, that cow knows more than we think he knows. This land was farmed differently than this land over here. This pasture was, the fertility was looked after, and that grass over there is more nutritious. And that cow is willing to inconvenience himself in order to get the more nutritious grass. Cows know. Now, here these cows don't have a choice. Or they may think they have a choice when they have no choice. And they're being fed, just what's not natural for a cow, just hay. You know, cows are mostly eat green grass. And in a way, here's a guy at Gaia Gardens, and he's picking up his order at a CSA, which is Community Supported Agriculture, which is you buy shares at the beginning of the year. Now, he's a little inconvenienced because he's got to be there from 4 to 7 on Wednesdays. He can't just pop in anytime he wants and pick up some food or whatever he wants. And he's got to get whatever's there, you know, for that pickup, whatever's harvest. But here's his basket of food. It's on a Wednesday between 4 and 7, which he makes himself available for. But this food is grown organically, and he lives in the townhome development, so he gets to walk there. And he seems pretty happy, even though he's inconvenienced. Now, here's a person who looks like they have a lot of free choice, but I mean, most of those foods are grown by like 3 or 4 big agricultural concerns, and they're not grown organically, okay? And there's kind of a correlation between this and this. And sometimes it's worth being inconvenienced, especially when it comes to something as intimate as putting food in our bodies. Here's a little chart about a study they did on organic versus conventional. And the nutrients, they have magnesium, phosphorus, and iron. And you can see, just to be real quick on this, you can see this is organic up here. And down here, this is conventional. And you can see, usually, the organic scored higher in all these nutrients. Not always, but usually. And organic is, remember, when I use the word organic, it doesn't guarantee a product. It does guarantee a process. And sometimes the process, right now the process is pretty good. And it, you know, saves our water supplies and our air, but it doesn't always guarantee a product. You can have low quality organic produce. Okay, I just bricked an organic tomato. Somebody was real proud of buying. You know, they spent big money on it, and it was the lowest bricks tomato I'd ever bricked. It was like 3, and that was even below store bought tomatoes grown conventionally. So it doesn't always mean they're better quality, but it does guarantee a process. And you can see most of the times though, organic does mean better nutrients, higher nutrients. But here, nitrates, you can see conventional had more nitrates. Nitrogen is used on a lot of our fruits, grains, nuts, and vegetables to get them big and get them looking good because we shop with our eyes, and the people that sell food know that. So they want the food looking big and good. But the thing with food grown with a lot of nitrogens is it has a lot of nitrogens, nitrate nitrogen in your food supply, too much of it, will affect your heart rhythms, and it affects your heart. So conventional agriculture uses a lot of nitrate. It's like a steroid or something for plants. This is the bricks, and I wanted to. While I'm going, how much time do I have? What time do I have to finish? I got 45 minutes. Okay. 35 minutes. Okay, I want to pass this around. This is a refractometer, and everybody should get one of these, and you can use it while you're farming. And I'm going over philosophy, a little philosophy now, but I'm going to get into the practical stuff. If I don't have time today, then I'll definitely get into it tomorrow. I'm not going to spend too much time on this philosophy, because I know I'm singing to the choir here. You wouldn't be here if you weren't already kind of sold on it. So, but maybe I'm bringing some things out that you hadn't considered. And a bell pepper according to the BRICS chart, and I'm reading it right off this chart, and it's not exhaustive, but if more people would get into this, we can make our own charts and start comparing, you know, the things that weren't on this chart. And we could start building our own BRICS, and we could shoot for higher BRICS. And it's just not farmers that are using this. These things are used in laboratories to measure viscosity and density of any kind of fluid, right? Grape growers use it out in California because they have a high, you know, grapes are a high dollar crop, you know, because they make all these big wines. And grape growers have been using this for years out there. But you can grow, you can use it on anything. And so for a nutrient, this measures total dissolved solids. And total dissolved solids is related to the nutrient density, okay? So that's how that's the relationship. Bell pepper, vegetable, 4 is poor, 6 is average, 8 is good, and 12 is excellent. It's probably up there, bell pepper. Yeah, it's the third one down on the right-hand side. So we'll look at this. This came from the supply thing over here. Okay, I'll pass this around, and you can look at it for yourself. It's all that is a scale, 0 to 32. That's BRICS. That's dissolved solids in that sap. I just squeezed out of that bell pepper. Well, what did you get? Can you see it? Yeah, it's a measure of the dissolved solids, which a lot of it is sucrose, yeah. But vitamins, minerals, you know, the nutrient density is related to how much health is in that bell pepper. Now, huh? Okay, the difference between the blue and the white line, I think I got 4, which is poor, you know, on here. What did you get?
4.
The fuzzier the line, the more calcium. So when you're looking at it, it's not a very fuzzy line. So a fuzzy line is a good thing. It's got more calcium. A non-fuzzy line is less calcium. But consumers, even if you don't grow anything, even if you're just a concerned consumer, you should buy a cheap one of these refractometers, carry it around in your purse, and talk to your produce manager and say, look, I'm not going to pay this, or you know, I'm not going to pay this for this low BRICS fruit. I want high BRICS fruit. Now, if you start demanding that, that produce manager is going to go back to his distributor and say, hey, my customers want high BRICS fruit. What, you know, do you know anything about that? You're going to have to educate people, and they'll back it up, and it'll get back to the farmer, because the only way you can grow high BRICS fruit or high BRICS vegetables is if you take the biology and the soil into concern, and it'll force farmers to go back to a more natural method, and you, the consumer, can do that. You don't even have to be a farmer to affect that. It's just how you spend your dollar and monitor your vegetables that are coming into your home. You can get them, you know, they have them online. I got a guy here. I'll pass these out. His are pretty reasonable. They're, you know, they're anywhere from $75 to, you can get digital ones for $800. But you know, this does a trick. I like simple. I don't want batteries or anything like that. And all it is, a prism. Okay, and the light's coming through the prism, and that extra sugar that I slap between that lens is a little extra thing, you know, a little extra material for the light to go through, and all that scale is measuring is the extra refraction coming through that sap. Okay, everybody understand that? Yeah, and if it's more density, if that liquid is more dense and more nutritious, you'll get a more refraction, and that's what you're measuring with that, okay? All right, where's the clicker?
If it's more riper, it'll be more dense.
Hmm?
If it's riper, it'll be more dense.
No, usually it's about how it's grown. It's about the balance of the soil, about the microbiology in the soil. Like I said, real quick little study here. This is on another slide, but when a root goes up against a mineral colloid, like a piece of rock, a tiny piece of rock that might have, and that plant needs iron. Let's say it's iron. Right now, that plant wants iron, right? Well, that iron could be bound so chemically bounded so tight on that soil colloid, and I'm talking about that little itty-bitty piece of rock, you know, that iron atom is on there so tight that that root can't get it off. Okay? But what can happen is that plant is making sugar all day long, right, with its leaves. At night, it dumps the sugar out, and some of that sugar gets used. Sugar's energy. It's stored sunlight. It's all sugar is stored sunlight. Some of that energy gets used to grow the plant and make fruit, right? But a lot of that energy, they say up to 50, sometimes 60%, gets pushed out the root into the little film around the fresh root hair. It gets pushed out the root, and that plant can change the chemistry Oh, I had a two things to it? Okay. I'll do that later. That root can change the chemistry of the sugar. It pushes out the root and if the biology's there. If it's not there, it can't do it. But if the biology's there, it can call the right biology, the right microbes into the rhizosphere, that's like dessert to a microbe. That sugar, it can't make sugar on its own. It goes in there, gets the sugar, but in return, it's like any other animal. It poops, it spits, it sweats, it leaves parts of itself in the root zone, and that microbe has processed or metabolized iron. And that sweat has iron in it, and now the plant can get that iron that it couldn't get off a piece of soil. But it took the biology being the mediator of that particular element. Okay, do you see how that works? The metabolites that the biology throws off, and that's how you get a hybrix plant. You really can't get a hybrix without the biology there. Because sometimes plants need iron only at a certain time in the plant. And when the plant can't get iron, it'll substitute some other element like nitrogen. And it'll go on its merry way, but it will never have the full nutrient package it should have had. So, is that kind of clear? It's pretty simple, right? Anyway, that's bricks. That's why we do some of these things. And on the back of the sheet, these sheets, which I agree, are a dollar piece on the back, it has, they did a test of beans, right? That's on the back here. They did a test of beans, and you can see that the grocery store beans, the grocery store beans bricked out at 4.2, the garden beans at 6.1. Doesn't sound like a lot. Maybe I do, yeah, thanks. Doesn't sound like a lot. But I did it on carrots one time. I had a row of carrots, and I had another row of carrots. Side by side, same soil, no difference, right? Same bed. And I foliar fed the one row of carrots with some seaweed. Thanks. Two-fifths a drinker. Anyway, thank you. Anyway, I sprayed with a foliar on those carrots some seaweed. You know, I heard they liked iodine. I just heard it. So I thought it couldn't hurt. Let's do a little experiment. So I foliar sprayed the tops of the carrots with the foliar. I did it maybe three times, you know, like a week apart. Well, when I pulled the carrots and I bricked them, the carrot I had bricks was like, I don't know what carrots are, but it was like a 6. And the carrots I hadn't bricks was like a 5. You say, well, big deal, one bricks. You know, one's a 5, one's a 6. Well, then I would take carrots around and I would, you know, have them in my hand behind my back. And I would let people taste. I'd say, okay, taste this one. And they didn't know. Taste that one. Every time, they picked the 6 bricks carrots. It's cheap, it's sweeter and better tasting. So that proved to me that there was something to this bricks. Okay, so that was kind of neat. And you can see that all the way down the line, protein, there's the USDA recommended, you know, 1.8 grams for green beans. Store-bought is 1.76 grams. And out of the garden, it's 3.34 grams. Okay, these are they've done the test. They've done the tissue analysis test on these things. And hybrix gardens that are grown with brick, you know, increasing the bricks in mind, but you have to be biofriendly to do that. I call it biofriendly. You don't necessarily have to be organic because I already told you you can have low bricks organic food. You have to be biofriendly though. You know, you have to be biofriendly to get the high bricks. But you can see they test higher. That second to the last column there. All those numbers, those milligrams and grams, are higher than the store-bought. I don't see one that's not higher, is it? No. They're all higher. Some a lot, some just a little. But that's more minerals and nutrients in your body for the same amount of food, and that's going to give you better health. So how you grow your food matters. All right. Now, getting into the soil food web. I've alluded a little bit to it. This is the soil food web. In the soil, you have your roots, and at the base of those roots, you have fungi, which are little thread-like looking things. They're even microscopic. You can't even see a lot of them. And very delicate, okay? And then you have bacteria. You can't see these things. They're invisible. And then you have some invisible nematodes. Not all nematodes are bad. 90% of the nematodes are good. There's only about 10% of the nematode population that's bad. What you want to do is not kill everything. What you want to do is encourage the good guys, Okay? Then you have sort of the middle-sized organisms here. You have your mesoarthropod. Meso means middle. You know, you can barely see them with the naked eye. They're very, very small, though, you know. And you have your mesonematodes, and you got protozoa, which are a little bigger, and they feed on bacteria and things like that. And then you got your big macro soil food web, which feed on the meso, which feed on the micro. Okay, and birds, earthworms are not up there, but got big nematode there, but earthworms and big beetles and stuff, ground beetles and stuff like that, they're all down there too, and they're feeding on each other. And then this is a very simplified chart. I mean, these little lines could run all kinds of ways, okay? And that's the soil food web, and that's a beautiful thing. And that's under your feet on every, you know, ground you walk on. And what you want to try to do is encourage that and not discourage that. And here, what we've kind of adopted is we have these two guys back in the 1800s, Louis Pasteur, which we've all heard of, and Claude Bernard, which none of us have probably ever heard of. Anybody ever heard of him? Okay. Well, Louis Pasteur got all the airplay. Claude Bernard gets airplay in Adventism. We just don't know it. Pasteur said the germ is everything and the terrain is nothing. Where Bernard said absolutely 180 degree opposite, he said the terrain is everything and the germ is nothing. Basically, our Adventist message is, if you keep the body clean and do the right things, 8 laws of health, the germs don't have a place to go. They don't like clean environments. They're kind of the cleanup crews for dirty environments, right? And so Claude Bernard had it right. But Pasteur won the day, and we've developed this thing called the germ theory. So if we get a disease, we want to kill everything. We want to nuke everything because we're afraid of anything we can't see. Don't be afraid of everything you can't see, because a lot of the things you can't see are there to help you. So you want to get a little more studious and learn about the things that are helping you that you can't see, and let them take care of the bad guys. When it comes to insects or herbicides or things like that, Pasteur said attack the insect. Bernard said no, don't attack the insect. Manage the environment better. Okay. So we kind of do that. Okay, I threw this in. I don't really get into this, but I threw this in because I noticed it in a lot of the soaps around here. Triclosan. So on the back, it's called anything that's got a hand soap, or now they're putting it in pillowcases, they're putting it in our clothes, they're putting it in underwear, bed sheets. This triclosan is just a renamed, repatented 2,4-D, which is a herbicide they use on the side of the road to kill weeds. Okay, that is just a derivative of Agent Orange they used in Vietnam. Okay, they have all these stockpiles of Agent Orange, and they're just sort of trying to use it up in our consumer products, and kind of microdosing us with them. Well, a lot of doctors have said these microdoses of this triclosan actually acts like microdoses of antibiotics, and you know it kind of can breed super germs. So again, this all stimulated from Louis Pasteur and the germ theory is like, if it's a bacteria, it needs to be dead. It's harmful. That's not true. Okay, not all bacteria is harmful. A good teaspoon of soil has millions of bacteria, has hundreds of feet of small little microscopic threads of hypha fungi. It has thousands of protozoa and dozens of nematodes, beneficial nematodes, predatory nematodes. And there, in that last picture, you have a predatory nematode attacking a root-eating nematode. Isn't that nice? Instead of you being worried about killing nematodes or trying to find some poison that'll kill all your nematodes and kill everything else along with it, why don't you try to make your soil so your predaceous nematodes will do the work for you 24/7? And that's the way. You shouldn't look at yourself as a gardener. You should look at yourself as a microbe rancher.
So the protozoa,
that
they're vegetarian are the bad ones, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Bugs. We don't like vegetarian bugs or vegetarian soil organisms. We like the carnivores. They eat the vegetarians. This is a picture of the rhizosphere. These are, and I'm talking root tips that are, I mean, these are under microscopes. I mean, they're like hair-like. You can't even hardly see these root tips. But here is good bacteria colonizing a root hair right there. This is a root tip actually pushing through the soil, and it's sloughing off root cells here. That's not bacteria, that's root cells. And then you can kind of see the rhizosphere here. It's the best picture I could get. You know, this where it sort of changes here. And it can be anywhere from 0 to 5 millimeters thick. And that's where all the sugar exudates are. And that's kind of the That's kind of the playground of all these good soil microbes that want to eat this sugar. And the plants want them to eat that sugar. That's why plants push it out there, so they can eat the sugar and swap. You know, it's an even trade. They get their metabolites. Here's another picture of bacteria around in the rhizosphere, those little sort of fluorescent green dots. Here's different kinds of bacteria. You know, the spheres and the bacillus, which are kind of like the capsules, and then your spirals. Now, this is kind of neat. Bacteria, this is, everybody heard of aerobic and anaerobic? Okay, what's aerobic? Likes the air, kind of simple there. Anaerobic, doesn't like oxygen. The good bacteria and the good fungi are air-loving microbes, okay? And so we need to keep that in mind when we're doing stuff, is that they love oxygen. The anaerobics hate oxygen. They like well-drained soils. The anaerobics like wet soils. Anaerobic soil smells bad. Anaerobic smells bad. Aerobic doesn't smell bad. Anaerobic soils produce harmful gases like formaldehydes and aldehydes. And certain weeds like those gases. But most of our food crops don't like those gases, and they don't do well. So you want to you want to take that in effect. That's how you encourage good microbes, is make sure there's oxygen in your soil, and you don't get that. You don't always get that by tilling. Bacteria decompose soft tissues. Okay, fungi decompose woody hard things, and then the bacteria take over once they get soft. Okay, so it's kind of a two-stage thing there. And actinobacteria, they slowly break down humates, which are sort of stable carbons, which is not always a good thing, and into humic acids, which is a good thing. I'm sorry, that is a good thing. So and there's certain bacteria that actually fix nitrogen in the soil. So all these good bacteria do a lot of wonderful things, and the most thing they do is they break down organic matter, but they break down the soft stuff. Does everybody know what this is? That's a legume root. Okay, and right there on the legume root is one of the nodules. And inside that nodule, and here is one of the rhizobium bacteria going inside that nodule, and there's a symbiotic relationship between that legume and that rhizobium bacteria, and it lives inside that nodule, and it allows that plant to take nitrogen from the air and fix it inside that nodule. So you get free nitrogen, organic nitrogen from the air, planting legumes, and you also inoculate your seeds that you plant, so you'll get that bacteria. You inoculate it with that rhizobium bacteria. It might exist in your soil, it might not. You want to make sure it does, because that's why you're planting it. Okay? Here's another bacteria, actinobacteria, and it doesn't need to have that sort of symbiotic relationship. It just fixes nitrogen from air all by itself, and it's sort of more thread-like. It looks like a fungi, but it's not. It's a bacteria. So that's some of the good things good bacteria can do. Bacteria 1, primary decomposers of dead, soft, wet tissue. 2, uses strong alkalis, and alkalis, we know, raise pH. Higher pH, the more alkaline your soil is. Okay, so that's an interesting thing to realize. The bacteria use alkalis to break down organic matter. And you know, bad bacteria, pathogenic bacteria, they also use alkalis to break down living cells. So we can address some disease problems knowing that bacteria use alkalis to do their damage on living cells. But, you know, the good bacteria use alkalis to decompose dead stuff, which we want to happen, right? But I've done experiments where I have taken a bacterial disease on a leaf or something and made a mild acid and sprayed on it, and actually, I didn't kill it, but I've halted the spread of the disease by using an acid and kind of neutralizing their alkali effect on living cells. So that's how you can use that information. When you put a lot of soft things into the soil, you increase your bacterial counts, because you know, soft tissue is going to increase your bacterial counts. It's going to raise your pH. Most organic farmers have high, you know, people say, well, you've got acid soil here. Well, if you're an organic farmer, you usually end up with alkaline soils, because it's very bacterial dominated, and bacterials push out a lot of alkalis to do their thing. Now, every morning you wake up, do I have a thing on that? Well, yeah. All right. Here, the next picture talks about this one. Bacterial slime. Doesn't sound like a really wonderful thing, but in soils it's really good. Bacterial slime. You ever wake up in the morning and rub your finger across your teeth like this, and you get that white junk, and you think, oh, gross, you know, I got to go brush my teeth? Well, that's how bacteria move around. And, you know, we sleep all night, we get these bacteria running around our mouth, and they actually help us in a way. But they also help the soil aggregation. And, you know, you want a dark, rich, chocolatey kind of crumb, and you want the bacteria in your soil, and they produce this slime, and it kind of aggregates your soil really well. Okay? So that's how bacterial slimes work for our benefit. And bacterial-dominated soils are favored by annuals. Most of the crops we grow them, we put them in the ground, they grow, we harvest them, and then we chop them down and till them under, right? They're there for 1 year. It's called an annual. They go through their whole, you know, from seed to seed in one growing season. Well, knowing this, bacterial annuals like bacterially dominated soils, okay? Perennials are woody. They don't. They like more fungally dominated soils. They're attracted to root exudates. Bacteria are. They mobilize leachable nutrients. They take up leachable nutrients and hold them in their body so you don't lose them out into every rain out into the watershed. They release bound available nutrients from inorganic rock. They are able to crush rock and munch on rock and release some of the nutrients on a rock particle. And they complex them with their bodies, and their bodies, every living thing has carbon in it. Well, as far as I know. Everybody know that? I mean, that's kind of the common denominator with all living things. We all have carbon. Well, they take some of these harder to attain nutrients. They metabolize them. They connect them in their bodies. They connect them with carbon. And now when they die, or when the next, or the, you know, when a crop dies, that next generation of crop can access that iron or that copper or whatever better from a carbon complexed molecule than it can from a minerally complex molecule. You know, something like a, well, what is clay? Like aluminum and silica or something like that. And you get an iron attached in there, and that iron's not coming off of there. But you get it complexed with inside a microbe's body, and all of a sudden, you know, the next generation of plant can access that iron off of that carbon complex where it couldn't before. And some are able to fix nitrogen from the air into the soil. We already covered that. That's just a guy sleeping, got morning breath, and he's got bacterial. This is that's bacterial slime on a tooth. So that's it. That's what it looks like. Bacterial slime, and bacteria use that to move around because they really can't move around too good. And here's a fungi, and this is different from bacteria. And you can see, anybody heard of mycorrhizal fungi? Yeah. Okay. Two people. Mycorrhizal fungi. This is a picture of mycorrhizal fungi. What is mycorrhizal fungi? I think I got another slide with that coming up. We'll get into that. But it actually, again, works as a symbiotic relationship. It actually puts a pod inside the roots, the cell of that root, and it can actually increase the nutrient gathering surface area of that root. And in exchange, the plant gives it sugar. So there's a symbiotic relationship. There's a give and take there. Here you have a fungi living on a surface of a root right there. Now this really changed a lot of people's minds about organic farming and biologically friendly farming. Here you have a root-eating nematode getting captured by a fungal form living on a plant root. And see, there's a symbiotic relationship. That fungal form is protecting that plant from getting harmed by the root-eating nematode. Isn't that cool? I mean, and if you farm this way, you can encourage this to happen. And these guys are working for you 24/7. You don't have to run down to Home Depot every time you get something. Your plants stay healthy; they don't even get the diseases. And then over here is just some regular hypofungi over here on the far side. So you kind of get in the picture here. Here is a mycorrhizal fungi, and you can see here's the root hair, and here it sets up shop. And out here, it's spore, it's reproductive, it's fruit. And out here, it's got it can gather and increase the nutrient gathering potential of this root. And it lives inside the cell roots. But that's okay. It's a good thing. It helps the plant gather phosphorus, especially. A lot of plants come up short on phosphorus. It's hard for a plant to take in phosphorus. And they say like 90% of the plants on, you know, especially pine trees and carnivorous, coniferous trees. They have to have mycorrhizal fungi in order to exist. They couldn't exist without mycorrhizal fungi. And they say like 90% of the plants on the surface of the earth have to have a relationship with mycorrhizal fungi in order to even be here. Some things like brassicas don't really need them. Okay, the brassica family crops don't really need mycorrhizal fungi. So they're not always there. But I put mycorrhizal on all my soils and all my planting trays because you want to establish that relationship early in the plant's life and not later. It's easier to establish that earlier in the plant's life. So I use inoculant on my germination dirt. The functions are predaceous fungi protect the plant, the mycorrhizal fungi extend the nutrient gathering capacity, and the hypofungi assist in the, again, those threads connect the soils. You know, you can't really do much about soil texture. You know, everybody knows soil consists of clay, which is really, really small, silt, which is like medium size, and then sand, which is like a big boulder. Okay? Everybody know that? That's the sort of the mineral side of soil. Okay? And then the organic side of soil is, you know, dead stuff that used, you know, stuff that used to be living is now dead and decomposed. And you get really small, and then you get sort of big called, sort of halfway decomposed material. And then you get stuff like mulch, which isn't hardly decomposed at all. Well, what happens is you can't really change your sand, clay, and silt makeup. That's kind of what you just inherit from wherever you are. You know, people try to go throw bags of sand, but some people say it doesn't really work. You know, it kind of slinks away and it goes reverts back to whatever your area is. And but what you can affect with by farming biologically friendly is how those things marry together and, you know, are connected together. And you want to, you know, and fungal hypha along with bacterial slime help aggregate that soil in a way that keeps the pore spaces open. And you want open pore spaces because you get water penetration that way and you get air penetration that way. And that's what organisms need. They need a little water, not too much, not too little, and they need some air, okay, in order to live, just like we do. Fungals are primary, like bacteria were soft tissue, fungi decompose hard woody stuff. Uses, instead of alkalines, fungus is used strong acids. Strong acids, you'll know you're in a fungal-dominated soil because it'll usually have a low pH. Okay? Acids, low pH. And it'll be a highly fungal. You know, forest floor stuff is usually low pH, highly fungal. Fungal-dominated soils are favored by perennials. So that's how you use that knowledge. If you're growing annuals, you probably want to put on some, you know, soft, decomposed stuff, you know, like some kind of compost as mulch. You know, something soft and you know, because that will encourage bacterial. If you're trying to grow a blueberry bush or a tree, that is something that would prefer fungal soils, so you want to mulch it with something woody, like, you know, wood chips, or the best wood chips are wood chips that have been decomposed, not mechanically ground up, because decomposed wood chips got a lot of fungal life in them. And then you're putting that around the root system, you know, of your plant, of your tree you're trying to grow, your fruit tree you're trying to grow. And they do really well around, you know, naturally broken down wood chips. They produce this stuff called, this sticky stuff called glomalin. And glomalin actually protects the little fragile thread-like bodies, but it's also a sticky substance that, again, helps with soil aggregation. And aggregation helps with porosity of your soil, allowing the water and the air to get in there. Attracted to root exudates, again, they like the sugar that the roots that the plant produces and pushes out through the roots too. They immobilize leachable nutrients just like the bacteria does, and they release bound up nutrients too. So you can see that that's good, and that's what fungals do. Here's some of the things you're going to find in that book, Teeming with Microbes. You know, diatoms, blue green algae, slime molds. Here's things about algae. We can go. We won't stop. We'll just sort of go through these because they do a lot of the same things.
4 minutes.
Okay, 4 minutes. Protozoa, which eat bacteria, which feed the other parts of the soil food web. And you know, everybody that knows earthworms are good, right? That's a good sign. But what makes earthworms a good sign is because earthworms don't really eat dirt. Earthworms eat the bacteria on the dirt, okay? And then they push the dirt back out their rear ends, and it's, you know, got higher nutrients than when it went in. But you, if you don't see earthworms, then that's an indication that you don't have the bottom part of the food chain there. You don't have the bacteria the earthworms are after. And that's not a good sign. A shovel full of good, rich dirt, you know, and you want to do it in the morning when it's cool, not in the heat of the day, but a shovel full of good, rich dirt that's somewhat moist should have at least 10 earthworms in it, you know, for high, fertile soil, okay? And then here's your nematodes. Here's the bacteria-feeding nematodes, which are good. We don't mind those. These are predatory nematodes, and you see the mouth part's different. These are sort of, for, you know, got the little flagelli there sucking in the bacteria. These are predatory nematodes, which got a little interior teeth that kind of grab and lock in, and, you know, they feed with that. And then you got your root-feeding nematodes, which, you know, have the little piercing thing that go inside roots and harm your plant. These are some of your orthopods. Orthopod means segmented legs, you know, Latin for segmented legs. And there's all kinds of sizes of these orthopods, and they're good. Not all of them are bad. And then here's your earthworm. Okay, this is a cool, taking it to Scripture. This is one verse that I always had questions about, Matthew 12, 43 and 45. You know, talking about when a spirit has gone out, it walks the earth, and when it comes back to where it went out, it finds it swept and clean. And you think, well, that should be a good thing. You know, swept and clean sounds nice. But, you know, he came out, and when he comes back, he finds it swept and clean and garnished. And he goeth, and he taketh with himself seven other spirits more wicked than himself, and they enter and dwell therein. Well, that's the thing. When you nuke your soils, and you get rid of everything, you sweep it clean of all biological life. Well, when it starts to repopulate, when some of that poison wears off, some of that high, rich fertilizer that is good for the plant, you know, it makes the plants grow, but it kills your microorganisms. It's the bad guys that always come back and repopulate. The bad guys don't want to populate a place where the good guys are established. You know, where the guardsmen, you know, the Bible talks, I think before that, the Bible talks about, you know, the guardsmen watching. When the guardsmen are there and they're watching, the bad guys slide on by because they're opportunists. When they come by and there's nobody home, there's no good soil life there because the way you farmed or you've tilled too much or the things you put on it, then they're going, hey, we can, you know, this is a place where we can lodge. And that's kind of, that verse started to make a lot more sense when I realized that that's what's going on in the soil. And here's a penetrating root-eating nematode going into a unprotected root. There is no biological life. This is a conventionally farmed root, and that's what you have, and you better throw a poison on it to try to kill it. But once it goes in, you can't kill it anymore because it's inside. It's protected. And then here you have there's a fertile soil with a predatory nematode eating the root-eating nematode, and then you have here's a fungal form eating a root-eating nematode and catching it in that little donut. I mean, that's just amazing, you know, to me. I mean, that should convince you to change your farming practices and go to a more biological-friendly form right there, because these guys are on duty 24/7. Most of your biological life is in the top 3 inches of your soil. You know, here we have bacteria, actinomycetes, fungi, algae, and you can see the percentages are way higher the higher up in the soil you go, and that's because they're aerobic organisms. They love oxygen. Most of your oxygen is in the higher levels. So how can you use that information? Well, try not to till so much, because when you till, you're going to destroy all those little fungal forms, you're going to mix up all the bacteria, you're going to kill your fungal forms, and you want to try to... When you do till, you want to try to till as little as possible and as shallowly as possible, okay? Because of this right here. And I'm not a promoter of no-till. I have some friends are, but I'm not. I believe in low-till, though. Anyways, we won't go. Let's go to the yellow one here. To get biologically started, work 1 inch of compost into the top 3 inches of soil. Okay, and just 1 inch, and 1 cup of blackstrap into 1 gallon of non-chlorinated water. Remember, city water's got chlorine in it, and that's not really conducive to biological life. So you're going to have to find some way to clean up your municipal water supplies. And you spray that on the ground, or you can use aerated compost teas. Yep, we'll get into that later, aerated compost teas. But that can promote biological life. Yeah, if you have a well, that's good. But there's sometimes the stuff, you know, with all this fracking going on and all that, you got to worry about your well water now. Okay, this is the why of a healthy soil food web.
It helps take minerals out of parent rock that was bound up too tight. It contributes to soil aggregation, assists water and air penetration into the soil. It enhances the cycling of nutrients. You know, dead plant material gets cycled back into something a living plant can use. Transforms nutrients from one form to another into new available compounds. Assists in plants in obtaining nutrients from soil metabolites, meaning living things that are actually living. Degrades toxic substances in the soil and minimizes disease. Using compost teas, aerated compost teas, meaning you aerate the tea instead of just letting it sit there and go anaerobic. Compost, manures, mulch, cover crops, that's the big one right there. I'm going to get into that coming up. Cover crop, you know, tomorrow, whenever I get another chance. Cover crops, that's a living, that's what I use to increase my soil fertility. Keeping this calcium-magnesium ratio 7-1. If you get it tighter than 7-1, the soils are going to tighten up. You're going to lose airspace. You're going to lose biology. Okay? You need to try to keep that soil to magnesium, calcium-magnesium ratio 7-1. You'll avoid unnecessary or untimely tillage. You never want to till wet soil. Everybody knows that, right? You lay out your beds, which is the next presentation, was layout. You lay out your beds so there's no foot traffic on your beds. Because when you walk on your beds where you're trying to grow, you're mashing the air right out of it. And then when you mash the air out of it, you lose your good microbes, okay? And then apply easy carbon or easy nitrogen in soil drenches. And I'm talking about easy carbon in an organic form. Like an easy carbon is you can mix up sugar in water, you know, non-chlorinated water, and spray it on your soils. That's an easy carbon. A lot of times I'll till in a green cover crop, high in nitrogen, right? I want it to break down fast. Okay, I want it to break down fast. And I'll spray some sugar water on it because microbes want carbon and they want nitrogen. Nitrogen is protein. All amino acids, the base nutrient, is nitrogen. So they use the nitrogen for protein for their bodies. You know, all our bodies are made up of a lot of protein. And they use the carbon like we use carbohydrates for energy. So when you have something that's high in nitrogen, they have all the protein they want, but now they need some carbon. And you can assist that breakdown if you throw carbon on there. If you till in a bunch of dead leaves, which are high in carbon, well, guess what? You can go get some fish emulsion, which is high in, you know, fish tissue. It's like ground up fish tissue. It's high in organic nitrogen, and that'll help break down some of the leaves, and you can break it down faster, and you can plant better, and everything becomes available better. And that's how you can use that knowledge to assist yourself. And these are things that are, they're not like Miracle-Gro. Miracle-Gro has a lot of high soluble stuff in it that'll cook, it'll nuke your biology, okay? Fish emulsion doesn't. It's carbon-based, you know? It's a living organism-based. Fish emulsion doesn't. What was the other thing? Oh, sugar. Sugar doesn't cook your biology either. It's a carbon-based thing, okay? It's easier on the biology. It's wet, and it's easy, okay? Because if you get stuff that's really highly soluble, like Miracle-Gro, and it's not biologically friendly, where Miracle-Gro isn't, it doesn't care, really. It's not into, you know, protecting the biology. It affects the plant, and you see a good positive thing in the plant, but you've nuked your biology in the process, and now you're kind of behind. Okay, I think that's it. And don't put any herbicides on. Don't use pesticides or limited pesticides. Slow-release dry soil fertilizers. You know, dry fertilizers that are slow-release. Some of these dry fertilizers are very soluble. You don't want that because that cooks your biology. OMRI-approved wet soil fertilizers. Wet foliar fertilizers and dry foliar dust. These are how you promote a healthy soil food web. That's the end.